The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story on warp speed raindrops. Dave, warp speed, at least as far as my Star Trek knowledge goes, is faster than the speed of light. These aren't really warp speed raindrops.
Right, Rob. These drops aren't actually traveling faster than the speed of light. But what they are doing is these smaller raindrops are traveling much faster than they should be. They're breaking what physicists thought was their speed limit. And the way this works is, if you can imagine a rainstorm, you've got your big drops and you've got your small drops. And because of wind resistance, these drops actually fall at different rates. And in fact, the big drops fall faster, just as a chair thrown out of an office building is going to fall faster to the ground than a feather thrown out of a window. So if there was no air, so say there was a rainstorm on the moon, these drops would fall at the same rate. But because of the influence of air resistance, we do have these larger drops falling faster. But that's not what scientists have actually seen. When researchers have gone out and measured raindrops, they've sometimes seen these small raindrops falling as fast as the large ones, which shouldn't be possible. So this new study is all about figuring out, well, how does this happen?
So why is it, Dave?
Well, Rob, it turns out that when you have these big rainstorms, these big drops can shatter midair, and that could be because they crash into other big raindrops. But what happens is you've got these big raindrops falling at their speed, which is a very fast speed compared to the small raindrops. And all of a sudden, they break apart into these smaller raindrops. And for those few moments that that happens, because a lot of times this will happen right before the drops hit the ground, those smaller raindrops are actually traveling at the same speed that the big drops were, because they've sort of taken that velocity from the larger raindrops. And they may start to slow down a little bit, but usually by the time they hit the ground, they're traveling a lot faster than they should be otherwise. So you can imagine maybe that chair thrown out of an office building, if there's a feather taped to the chair, and right before the chair hits the ground, the feather becomes detached, that feather's probably going to hit the ground at a much faster speed than it would otherwise.
So this phenomenon of the smaller raindrops traveling just as fast as the larger raindrops is because of the instant that the scientists are measuring the smaller raindrops close to the ground when they've just broken apart from being big raindrops.
Exactly. And actually, this study, apart from being kind of neat, has some practical implications as well. A lot of times when researchers are measuring the amount of rain that's hitting the ground, they're not looking at the actual number of raindrops. They're looking at the speed of raindrops hitting the ground. So they're saying, well, there's a lot of raindrops hitting the ground really fast, so there must be a lot of rain. But if it turns out that a lot of those raindrops are actually small raindrops that are hitting the ground, then there may not be as much rain hitting the ground as meteorologists think there is. And so this could have implications for not only telling us about the weather we're experiencing right now, but potentially even forecasting future weather patterns.
Okay, so what other stories have you got with you today?
Well, Rob, speaking of water hitting the Earth, how about water as is important for life? And this next story has to do with the so-called habitable zone. And this is what astronomers look for when they're looking at all these extrasolar planets that are out there. And we found a few hundred of them so far. And obviously, one of the very first questions they ask themselves is, once they find these planets, is this a planet capable of supporting life? And right now, they have a very narrow definition of how they define whether a world can support life. What they're looking for is hints that that world could have liquid water on it.
So the zone is not too far away from the sun and not too close.
Right. You can think of it sort of like Goldilocks. If the planet has to be just far enough from the sun, if it's too close and it has any water, all that water is going to be gas in the atmosphere. And if it's too far away, all that water is going to be ice. But it turns out, according to this new study, that astronomers should really be adding another criterion into the mix. And this criterion has everything to do with volcanoes. And it turns out that volcanoes are actually really important for life. Even on Earth, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for volcanoes. The volcanoes that were present on a very early and very geologically active Earth were spewing a lot of carbon dioxide and also water vapor into the atmosphere from deep within the Earth. And carbon dioxide became very important because it helped form our atmosphere, but it also was an important gas for the first photosynthesizers on Earth. And obviously this water was very important because we all need water to live.
But I imagine just like the Goldilocks situation, right? Too much volcanism could be bad too.
Exactly. Too much volcanism is bad. And we see that on one of Jupiter's moons, Io, which has a lot of what geologists call tidal forces. And these are caused by Jupiter and other moons basically pulling on this moon. And these forces create a lot of volcanism on the surface of Io, which causes basically the planet to be coated in lava every million years or so. And you can imagine that's not very good for life. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have Mars, which doesn't have a lot of tidal forces on it and isn't very volcanically active. And because of that, it's a dead world.
So the tidal forces are acting on the magma as opposed to water, like we think of it here. And that pulling of the magma, or the pulling of the lava, is sort of what causes the volcano to occur.
Yeah, they're basically causing a lot of, these tidal forces are basically causing a lot of geological instability, which is causing these eruptions.
So in looking at other planets, planets outside of our solar system, and seeing whether or not they're habitable, what else will scientists be looking for then in terms of these tidal forces?
Well, in this study, they actually have an interesting test case. It's an extrasolar planet called GJ581D, and none of these extrasolar planets have very friendly names, but that's this one's name. It's about 20 light years away, and theoretically, it seems like it should be habitable, potentially, because it's a rocky planet like Earth, and it's just far enough away from its sun that there could potentially be liquid water on the surface. But when these researchers looked at the tidal forces on the planet, they saw that there wasn't very much tidal force being exerted on GJ581D. And that means it's probably a world more like Mars. It's not very geologically active, and therefore it may not be spewing CO2 or water vapor into the atmosphere like Earth did, and because of that, wouldn't be a good candidate for life.
So another litmus test, basically.
Another litmus test for life in extrasolar planets.
Okay, and last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of how life came to be, this last story is about evolution in action. And it's always nice, we talk so much about evolution in biology, it's always nice to see these little snapshots of actually researchers seeing what they think is evolution actually occurring on timescales that we can measure. And this study has to do with flycatcher birds. And these are these small birds. The birds in this study live on the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific. And a famous biologist, Ernst Mayr, in the 1940s, noticed that the flycatchers on these islands seem to have started to speciate. In other words, even though there was one species of flycatcher on all these islands, there were about five different subtypes that looked like they were sort of deviating from each other. And in fact, there's two different birds that live on islands that are about 10 kilometers apart from each other. And one is an all-black bird or an all-blue-black bird. And the other one is only black on its back, and its belly is sort of a brown chestnut color. And you can see pictures of these birds on the site.
And so these are both flycatchers, but they're on their way to becoming different species.
Well, that was the question in this study. You know, these birds look different. They don't seem to be different species yet, but are they on the road to becoming different species? And what the researchers did was they focused on the color because that was the most salient difference between these two birds. And they homed in on a gene for something called the melanocortin 1 receptor. And this is a protein that researchers already know in sheep and pigs controls how black these animals are. And they wondered if the same gene was responsible for the different patterns of blackness in these two birds. And indeed, they found that there was a very small change. In fact, a change that caused a single amino acid to be different in this receptor between the brown-chested birds and the black-chested birds. And this single change was all that was needed to change the bird's chest black. So now the researchers had a genetic basis for this divergence between these two types of birds. But in order for speciation to happen, you can't just have a genetic difference. You actually have to have a difference that's going to cause these birds to stop mating with each other and eventually be able to not mate with each other at all, and thereby fulfill the definition of what it means to be a different species.
So they did some sort of behavioral study next?
They did. And what they did was they took stuffed flycatchers, one that was all black and one that had a brown chest, and they put them in the territories of each of these birds. And what the researchers found is that the birds attacked the birds, the stuffed birds that looked the same as them, and ignored the birds that looked different from them. And what researchers know about territorial birds, like these flycatchers, is that the same cues that tell them, you know, whether to attack the same kind of bird also tell them which mates to choose. So even though these researchers haven't quite yet shown that these color differences lead to mating differences, they've at least identified a similar behavior which could cause the different colored birds to stop mating with each other, which would lead to speciation down the line.
So we're seeing a snapshot here along the path of a speciation event. Is that how it's being received by other scientists?
Yeah, and scientists are excited about this, although they caution that because the team actually hasn't seen definitive behavioral differences, especially in terms of mating yet, they can't conclude that speciation is actually happening here, even though it looks like it is.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about tracking penguins with their poop. And actually, this week, we have a story about tracking tigers with their poop. And it's a bit of a different strategy, but it's really important for tiger conservation in the wild. So be sure to check out that one.
They're not using satellite data, then.
They're not using satellite data. And we've also got a story about the mystery of sunspots. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into what role Obama is playing in climate change policy, and also how U.S. students are faring in math compared to the rest of the world. Turns out not very well. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.